content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, a magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll begin today's program with an article titled Beyond Fairy Tales by Vanessa Braganza. The profound and long forgotten influence of the first book to take children seriously. It is a universally familiar phrase. Ask any English-speaking child or adult, and they will recognize the label Goody Two Shoes as derogatory shorthand for an insufferable prude. But few remember how it became a staple of American culture, of popular culture. Before her name became synonymous with sickly sweet virtue, Goody Two Shoes was the protagonist of the first English children's novel, The History of Little Goody Two Shoes. First published in 1765, the book was a groundbreaking work. It tells the life story of an orphan girl, Marjorie Meanwell, whose poverty reduces her to rags and to wearing just one shoe. When her fortunes improve and she acquires some new footwear, her excitement earns her the nickname Goody Two Shoes. For more than a century, this largely forgotten Cinderella story broke social and literary barriers while delighting readers. The book appeared in many editions in England and the United States, and it was beloved among famous writers like Robert Southey and Jane Austen, who kept her childhood copy until her death. One of the earliest works of children's literature, Marjorie Meanwell's Adventures, offered a striking alternative to prevailing gender norms. Over the course of the novel, Marjorie teaches herself to read, foils a major robbery, founds a school, earns her own living, stands up for animal rights, and overcomes accusations of witchcraft. She was everything that 18th and 19th century British society thought woman shouldn't be. Poor, well-educated, self-made, and unmarried, at least until the last few pages. Marjorie was wildly popular and one of the first heroines whom juvenile readers admired. It's no stretch to say that the novel launched and definitively shaped children's literature into a genre intended to entertain young readers while teaching foundational values like generosity, hard work, and the virtues of education. It continues to exert an enormous, if forgotten, influence on culture today. Anyone who unconsciously quotes its title has been shaped by this book without knowing it. The earliest versions of the novel, produced by John Newbery, one of the first publishers of children's books, do not name an author, although some later scholars have attributed it to Anglo-Irish writer Oliver Goldsmith. In the tale, the angelic Marjorie's impoverished father is relentlessly persecuted for his debts by two grasping loan sharks named Sir Gripe and Farmer Graspall. English novels in the 18th century and 19th centuries often use characters' names to express personality types. Charles Dickens's Scrooge, a notorious skinflint, is one example. When Marjorie's father falls ill and dies, the two villains take what little money he has, leaving Marjorie and her brother orphaned, homeless, and in rags. A wealthy stranger adopts Marjorie's brother, but leaves her behind. Before the benefactor departed, though, he buys some new clothes for Goody, including a new pair of shoes. Scant though this consolation prize might seem for an abandoned child, Marjorie is overcome with excitement. She runs at once to show them off to the clergyman's wife, exclaiming, "Two shoes, ma'am, two shoes." In the process, she earns her immortal nickname among the villagers. Although today the term goody refers to an excessively moral person, until the 18th century, goodman or goodwife, abbreviated as goody, were equivalents of the modern titles Mr. and Mrs. The nickname is a simple but poignant joke on the part of the villagers. Although Goody doesn't marry and become a true good wife until the very end of the novel, She suddenly has the very adult responsibility of making her own living. For the rest of the novel, she does something unusual for a woman in the 18th century. She fends for herself. Goody begins to make her way in the world by providing herself with an education. Left alone with neither brother nor guardian, the narrator says she, quote, wanted all of the things to become wise and thought that to be wise she needed to read. For this purpose, she used to meet the little boys and girls as they came home from school, borrow their books, and sit down and read till they returned, end quote. Once she teaches herself to read, the enterprising young girl carves out a stable living by devising an innovative system to instruct the village children in reading and writing. She carves multiple sets of alphabet books out of wood, which she teaches her young pupil to arrange to spell syllables, words, and finally sentences. Some of Goody's approaches will even be familiar to readers today. For instance, she teaches her students the skill of focused, meditative thinking with the help of a hat that they are supposed to wear while thinking hard about a question. What Goody dubs her considering cap is actually the first instance of a thinking cap. Goody's innovative, hands-on teaching methods earn her the respect and admiration of the community. She even becomes a beloved teacher at the local school. No sooner was she settled into this office, the narrator tells us, but she laid every possible scheme to promote the welfare and happiness of the little ones, including teaching the poorest students free of charge. At the same time, what begins as a moralizing tale turns into a remarkably bold story about a self-educated, independent woman. Ultimately, Goody conquers every challenge life throws at her and flouts nearly all of 18th century society's expectations of a woman. Her virtuous example also ushered in a burgeoning genre, literature for children and adolescents. Moral tales had existed and become popular in Western literature for a long time, including Aesop's Fables, which originated in Greece in the 6th century BC, stories with ethical lessons to impart, like Jean de La Fontaine's The Crow and the Fox, and Edmund Spenser's Mother Hubbard's Tale were popular throughout the Renaissance among adult readers. It wasn't until the late 17th and 18th centuries that didactic stories emerged as literature intended primarily for younger readers. Goody was at the frontier of this new genre and helped to define it. Unlike its ancestors in the realm of fables, Goody set up children's literature as a genre that promoted women's independence. This was a timely innovation, and Goody's enterprising methods of self-education parallels some lively debates in the 18th century about whether women should receive an education equivalent to that of men, and whether they should use their education to become professionally and socially independent. Susan Manley, a scholar of 18th century English and Irish literature at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, suggests that Goody became popular and enduringly influential because it dispenses with magic and fairy tales, placing its action in a recognizably real world of economic struggle. The book, Manley says, encouraged writers including Anna Letitia Barbauld and Maria Edgeworth to set their stories for children in the real world. Edgeworth, one of England's first authors of novels for children and a major advocate for women's education, certainly took a leaf from Goody's book. One of her children's stories, titled The Orphans, published in 1796, is about a group of children whose honesty helps them overcome poverty and the schemes of a greedy old woman named Goody Grope. And while Jan Fergus, professor emerita of English at Lehigh University, writes that Goody is almost an icon of female power and possibility, Goody wasn't just for girls. In the second half of the 18th century, a census in England's West Midlands found the history of Little Goody Two-Shoes was immensely popular among 9- and 10-year-old boys. During a trip to Harvard University's Houghton Library to examine rare early copies of the book, I was astonished at the number and variety. Even several full days was scarcely enough to examine the many editions published in the 18th and 19th centuries. Goody Two Shoes was revolutionary in its determination to treat young people's experiences as seriously as those of their parents, and to do so in adult form, the novel. In doing so, it launched a publishing phenomenon that is still with us today. Many of the most successful children's fiction in the 20th and 21st centuries, including The Chronicles of Narnia, Mary Poppins, and Harry Potter, have in their way sought to fill Goody's shoes. Next, we'll move on to an article titled History from Scratch by Amy Crawford. Cutting-edge tools are rescuing ancient graffiti from obscurity and preserving them forever. Beginning with its construction in the 4th century BC and continuing for more than 800 years, the Temple of Isis on the small island of Philae, set where the Nile flowed out of Nubia, was visited by a stream of pilgrims. Coming from all parts of the Egyptian Empire, and even as far away as Cyprus and Rome, they passed between 60-foot towers to attend elaborate seasonal ceremonies and celebrated Isis's miraculous resurrection of her husband, the god Osiris, and the birth of their son Horus. They besieged Isis, the queen of the Egyptian pantheon, for aid and thanked her for interceding in their affairs. Before heading home, many also etched marks, a carving of their footprints on sacred ground, a picture of the deity, a name, a date, or perhaps a short prayer, into the temple's massive sandstone blocks. Some testified to the difficulty of their journey. "Isis, you are the mistress of the road," wrote a 3rd century AD Nubian envoy named Sasan beside a crude self-portrait. "Our hearts are entrusted to you upon the way." Others, who were likely carved on pilgrims' behalf by the priests who worked at the temple. "His name endures forever, Nesmedi, the banker of Isis. As for one who will erase these writings, his name will be erased forever." When European explorers began visiting Philae in the 19th century, more than a millennium after the cult of Isis slipped into history, they labeled these informal inscriptions graffiti, from the Italian for scratches. To these visitors, the phenomenon was a curiosity at best, and at worst, vandalism. Contemporary graffiti, like the messages recently carved by tourists on the wall of Rome's Colosseum, is still considered vandalism. For generations, most archaeologists were principally interested in the temple's epic architecture and the official ornamentation on its walls, which included intricate reliefs of gods and goddesses carved by skilled artisans. But over the last 2 decades, the etchings of the worshippers at Philae and other sites across the ancient world have gradually become the focus of serious inquiry, part of a broader turn away from the monarchs and monuments that long dominated our study of the past and limited our historical perception. People are looking more at women, the enslaved people who have been left out of the historical record, and graffiti are really one of the best ways to get at these voices, says Jacqueline DeViasi Sammons, a classicist at the University of Mississippi, whose research centers on graffiti in the doomed Roman cities of Herculaneum and Pompeii. The tools of ancient graffiti artists were simple, a knife, a chisel, perhaps a stick of charcoal. But these researchers have the advantage of breakthrough technology that is helping them recover, preserve, and publicize these etchings, from sophisticated image capture to massive online databases and even artificial intelligence. The Ancient Graffiti Project was digitized thousands of Roman graffiti since its founding at Washington and Lee University in Virginia in 2014. In Italy, researchers are documenting graffiti in medieval churches using a technique called photogrammetry. Last year, an international team of researchers debuted Ithaca, a deep neural network, a form of artificial intelligence, designed to read damaged or incomplete Greek inscriptions. And one of the most ambitious projects to date, a Canadian team has been working since 2016 to create a 3D model of the Temple of Isis that will allow researchers to explore in intimate detail the devotions of people like Sasan and Nesmiti, who lived and died millennia ago. The Philae temple complex is technically no longer on Philae. in the late 1970s. It was carefully disassembled and moved block by block to Ajilkia, a higher island a quarter mile downriver, after Philae was just flooded by the construction of the Aswan High Dam. Still, Isis's rebuilt temple retains its power to inspire awe. Looming over Nile as visitors approach in flat-bottom riverboats, much as pilgrims might have done in the age of pharaohs. "The ferry ride never ceases to amaze me," says Sabrina Higgins, an archaeologist at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia and a co-leader of the Canadian research team. To go to Philae feels as if you're stepping back in time. It's easy to imagine the festivals and rituals that once took place here. Higgins says the flotillas bearing effigies of the gods, the solemn reenactments of Osiris's funeral rites, the especially true early in the morning, before all the tourists arrive, when the island is the sole domain of hundreds of feral cats who are fed by workers there, and a throwback to the age where Egyptians considered felines to be divine. It's also the time of day when, thanks to the angle of the sun, the graffiti is easiest to capture in photographs. Much of Philae's graffiti consists of prayers and names in demotic script, a form of Egyptian writing that succeeded hieroglyphics, used primarily by priests and officials in an era when few people could read and write. Higgins and her colleagues, though, are concentrating on figural graffiti, which range from humans and animals, often representing a god, to game boards likely carved by Isis's priest for diversion during off hours. A falcon in flight honors Isis's son Horus, the great god commonly depicted with the head of a bird of prey. A crude line drawing of a horse is set so high on a wall that the artist must have been sitting on the roof with his legs dangling over the edge. The figures are at least as interesting as textual graffiti, says Jitse Dykstra, a classicist at the University of Ottawa, who has been studying Philae's graffiti for more than 20 years and was among the first scholars to examine it seriously. Dykstra began the current survey in 2016 with his Ottawa colleague, Roxanne Belanger-Sarazin. Higgins joined the project in 2020 and later recruited Nicholas Headley, a geographer at Simon Fraser who had previously worked with oceanographers to map the seafloor and with NASA to model the surface of Mars. Headley contributed his expertise in digital visualization, plus a dazzling array of high-tech gadgetry, which the team believes will one day be central to future graffiti projects. Headley began his survey with photogrammetry, a technique originally developed for architectural surveying in the 19th century that has become increasingly powerful since the advent of digital photography. Digital photogrammetry uses a mosaic of hundreds of overlapping images, each captured from a slightly different angle, to construct a high-definition, three-dimensional representation of each surface, not only walls but also rooftops, stairwells, and the sides of columns. The photogrammetry requires unbroken light, which can be rare in the Philae complex. So on a subsequent trip, Headley brought a brand new piece of technology, a small, powerful laser scanner about the size of a soda can. Even in the temple's darkest recesses, the device could capture images of graffiti that may have been unseen by human eyes for centuries. "That was a game changer," Belanger-Sarazin says of the new portable laser scanner. "In 2016, we were still using tracing paper on walls. Later, we changed to doing drawings from photographs. But sometimes on the photographs, we didn't see all the details, the depth, the texture of the wall and the graffiti in its context." Context can reveal a lot about where pilgrims were allowed to go, which areas were limited to priests, and how worshippers chose to express their devotion. On a Zoom call from his office at Simon Fraser, Headley walks me through a 3D model in progress and notes a particular concentration of graffiti just outside the most hallowed part of the temple, where people apparently chipped off pieces of sandstone as souvenirs. The human-made gouges and the graffiti in this spot, Headley says, suggests that many worshippers were prevented from entering and instead crowded outside. There would have been a threshold of access, Headley says. This was the holiest of holies. Much like Philae's ancient pilgrims, today's tourists do not have full access to the Temple of Isis, nor can everyone travel to this fairly remote part of southern Egypt. But the Canadian team is working to create a detailed digital model of the entire temple that they plan to eventually make widely accessible. Nobody has thought to use this kind of technology for capturing graffiti before, Higgins says. As a conservator and someone who has studied ancient graffiti, I think it's a wonderful form of preservation, says Suzanne Davis, head of conservation at the University of Michigan's Kelsey Museum of Archaeology and the president of the American Institute for Conservation, who has been following the project from afar. But it also has the huge benefit of making the graffiti available to students and scholars all over the world. Ancient graffiti do show how much things have changed in 2,000 years, but they also show us how much is just part of the human condition, DiBiase Salmon says. After all, at any given time in history, everyday people are living their ordinary lives. Few of us will build monuments, live in palaces, or have our names and deeds recorded in official histories. Still, the urge to leave a mark seems universal, whether it's a declaration to a deity, to posterity, or simply to oneself. I was here. Another little side article is written in stone by Amy Crawford. Graffiti preserved at Pompeii and Herculaneum offer an intimate look at everyday life, unrequited with a vengeance. While some Pompeians sent hopeful prayers to Venus, one apparently spurned suitor turned against the goddess of love, etching, "I want to break Venus's ribs. She can pierce my tender heart. Why can't I break her head with a club?" Everyone's a critic. Pompeii's basilica was the city's main administrative building, as well as a top spot for taggers. As one wit put it when adding graffiti to the tableau, "I'm amazed, O wall, that you haven't fallen into ruins since you hold the boring scribbles of so many writers." Mark of the Beast. Figural graffiti was common in Roman cities, but the artist's motives could be mysterious. One striking but baffling example is a monstrous woman with horns, wings, and oddly long toenails carved into the wall of a house in Herculaneum. Are you not entertained? Gladiators are one of the most common subjects in Roman graffiti. One vivid pair was found in a theater corridor clashing with a short sword and a spear. Spectators were very invested in their favorite athlete, says Rebecca Benefiel, co-founder of the Ancient Graffiti Project, an online database of graffiti from the two doomed cities. Love conquers wall. People on the margins of society are less likely to leave their marks on history, but one enslaved woman managed to do that by scratching her amorous hopes into a wall. Methe, a slave of Cominia from the town of Atella, loves Crestius. May Pompeian Venus be propitious in her heart to them both, and may they always live harmoniously. Finally, we'll read an article in Forensics titled Facing the Past by Ted Scheinman. How do we know what ancient humans looked like inside the high-tech world of forensic art? Hugh Morrison specializes in bringing the dead back to life and giving a face to the faceless. Born in Inverness, Scotland, and currently based in Thailand, Morris is a freelance forensic artist. His canvas is a laptop, and he often works with the police and private investigators to reconstruct faces of unidentified corpses. He also works with archaeologists, among whom he has become the go-to guy for recreating likenesses of figures from centuries or even millennia ago. It's painstaking work. For his history projects, Morrison refers to CT scans or photographs of skeletons and skulls, as well as paintings, tapestries, busts, sculptures, and historical accounts to fashion the most accurate and compelling portraits. When there's ancient DNA analysis available, Morrison can even get a good idea of what hair and eye colors would have been. Morrison honed his skills at drafting and digital art at the Edinburgh College of Art, and later during his master's work in forensic art at the University of Dundee. He made some of his earliest forensic portraits in 2015 for the Edinburgh City Council, reconstructing the faces of late medieval residents of the city based on bodies and old burial sites. Morrison's more recent work includes a striking 2022 portrait based on the remains of the first pregnant mummy to be found in Egypt. And this summer, he made headlines for his vivid depiction of a teenage girl from the 7th century AD, known as the Trumpington Girl, whose body was uncovered in Cambridgeshire, England, in 2012. Isotopic analysis performed this past spring on the Trumpington girl's bones revealed a curious change in diet, indicating that she moved from continental Europe, perhaps Germany, to England. It's impressive work, but without ancient DNA analysis, Morrison has some doubts about the eyes. It was open to my own interpretation, so I chose blue eyes and brown hair, as those are both fairly common for European Caucasian individuals, Morrison says. For his process, Morrison says it's about gathering every possible detail and then maintaining a rigid focus. It's important not to let any outside influences get in the way of precision and accuracy. Once it comes down to actually creating a face for a client, whether it be historical or forensic, I avoid looking at any other images unrelated to the task at hand so that it is only thing in my mind for a few days until everything is completed. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.